Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, I'm a journalist based out in Reykjavik, Iceland, where today the skies are grey, but it's nice and warm. It's an interesting start of summer, as usual for us, but as long as it's not horrible outside, I'm perfectly fine with it. And this week I've been playing a whole bunch of interesting games. One of them really caught my attention and really dominated my gaming life. I've actually played through it several times to its conclusion, because it's a multi-ending game. It's a really interesting card-based game about conversation called Signs of the Sojourner. And I actually had a conversation with a couple of friends of mine about how one pronounces sojourner. I thought it was sojourn. I thought it was a French word. I had a friend who was saying sojourn. And it turns out that it's sojourn, not a French word at all. So it's Signs of the Sojourner, an indie game that I got as part of the Black Lives Matter bundle for Itch that came out last summer. So I'm still managing to get good value out of that amazing package of over 1,000 games that raised so much money for Black Lives Matter. But Signs of the Sojourner is out on a whole bunch of consoles. It came out this year for the consoles too, so a whole lot of new people will be getting a chance to play that one. It seems like a good time to talk about it. But I also played a couple of other games too. I dipped into Bioshock Infinite, as I mentioned last week, after a conversation with my friend Kieran from Radical Art Review about games that are about quantum loops and time and stuff like that. And he said, you've got to play Bioshock Infinite. So I tried the original Bioshock, but bounced because it was creepy. But I'm actually really into Bioshock Infinite. I'm plowing through it almost at the end. So perhaps next week I'll talk a little bit more about it after I finished it. I also dipped into an Apple Arcade game that's been doing the rounds called Cozy Grove, which is like, I guess the pitch for it is that it's like Animal Crossing but spooky. So you land on an island where you are greeted by a campfire that talks to you and a bunch of spirits that haunt the island. And as a spirit scout, your job is to talk to them and help to, I guess the end game is going to be that you help to put them to rest, maybe. But I've been dipping into it. It hasn't struck me in the same way that it seems to have struck others. I didn't play Animal Crossing when it came out, even despite all of the hype and the community last year the temptation was real. But I kind of know that those kind of collectathon crafting games don't really grab me that much. And I'm finding that with Cozy Grove 2, you just run around and you kind of... Someone says, I need 5 leaves. You walk around your little island, which is really small, and find the 5 leaves. It's like a hidden object game. A little bit like I Am Dead. And if you heard the I Am Dead episode last year, you'll know that I didn't really gel with that one. But I am aware that the appeal of those games is that you check in every day and do more stuff and improve your island. So I'm going to give it a go. I've played 3 days and done about half an hour each day. And I'm going to give it a couple more days just to see if it sticks with me. Because you never know, right? And the art style is good, the music is good, and the concept is fun, but the gameplay isn't quite getting me. But I'm going to give it a little bit more of a chance because it's on Apple Arcade. I've got it on my phone. It's really fun to just plug in the phone into the Backbone controller and play an hour of Cozy Grove. So I'm going to give it a little more time. I also dipped into Streets of Rage 4 because it came onto PlayStation Now, so I could play it for free. It's a game that I saw the hype about, and I was an original Streets of Rage player when I was a kid. And so I was quite interested to see if the Streets of Rage 4 hype was real, you know. So I dipped into it, I played a couple of rounds, and I have to say, it felt very primitive to me, the gameplay. I know it's a very old style of game, the side-scrolling beat-em-up, and that for some people it was like a big sort of retro game treat to have an old series that they really have fondness for come out with an improbable fourth edition. But for me, I thought this is the same gameplay as back in the day. You kind of walk from left to right, you pick up pipes, you punch and kick and jump and kind of avoid obstacles, and the foes just keep on coming. And I felt like I'd seen everything that it had to offer within the first half an hour, and I just kind of thought, nah, it's not for me. So I bounced on Streets of Rage 4. Maybe it was just a mood thing. Maybe I'll come back to it later. But it didn't hit the spot for me personally. Never mind. It was free on PlayStation Now, so I'm glad I didn't shell out 20 quid for it on Switch after all. I also got one interesting new review code this week, so I'm adding to my list of games to cover King of Seas, an interesting game which is like a procedurally generated piracy game where you take your ship out onto the open seas and go forth and have ocean combat and land on islands, look for treasure and all of that kind of stuff. It looks like an interesting game, so I'm quite happy to have added that one to my PS4 collection. It's out in a couple of weeks. I'm going to take it for a test drive next week, and I'll be reporting back on that one soon. And I think today, after I finish this podcast, I'm going to go and try and finish Bioshock Infinite, because the plot is getting really interesting. So that's been my gaming week. But before I start talking about Signs of the Sojourner, I will mention that this show has a Patreon. I hit my first goal last week or the week before, which was to get 15 patrons. So I'm going to start making more special episodes for them. I've reset the goal to 30, and I think if I can get 30 patrons supporting the show, it will completely cover the costs of doing the show, of like sourcing games to cover, upgrading equipment and that kind of thing. So that's my new goal. If you're interested in supporting this show, if you are a first-time listener or a long-time listener who's been thinking about it, you can do so at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. There's a whole bunch of fun perks there, like our Discord community to talk to other listeners and myself and share screenshots and recommendations and hear about new games, weekly sale recommendations, extra episodes, all kinds of fun stuff. So that's patreon.com/gamingintheWild if you'd like to become a supporter of the show. And with that out of the way, let's move on and talk about this week's featured game, Signs of the Sojourner. So Signs of the Sojourner is a 2020 indie game by a company called Echo Dog Games, a three-person indie developer based in LA. It came out in 2020 for Mac and Windows, so Steam and all the usual places, and then in 2021 it came out for PlayStation 4, Switch and Xbox. It's available on all of those consoles now. I played it on my MacBook and it was perfectly fine. It's a good point-and-click type game. I imagine that it's probably designed with a mouse in mind, but the reviews seem pretty consistent across all of the platforms, so I think you're safe playing it on the Switch or on console. But I played it on a touchpad Mac and it was great. The soundtrack is by Skewsound and Steve Pardo, and I have to say it's a wonderful soundtrack. It really captures the atmosphere of this game, and this is a game with a lot of atmosphere. It's a very dusty road trip desert game, and it has this lovely soundtrack, honestly. Just the guitars and the propulsion. Every town that you come to in your exploration has a new theme. People have individual themes. There's a lot of music in this game, and I think it really helps to build a sense of personality in each new place, that you'll get used to the sounds of the cities. You'll get used to the atmospheres that the music creates every time you go back, and it's quite effective in describing each new place that you discover. I've listened to that soundtrack outside of the game. I've been listening to it on Spotify, and it's really my taste. I've really been enjoying it. And as for the critical response to the game, it's done quite well. It has an average of about 80 across all of the formats. It has an 80 on Switch, 77 on PC, 80 on PlayStation 4. The console reviews are still coming in, but I am happy to see that there is no mention of the control scheme not working without the mouse, so I assume that they have translated it successfully to control their play. And one review that stood out to me as I was scanning them came from Edge, which gave it a 9 out of 10. And they said, "This is a game of rare thematic consistency and mechanical brilliance," which is pretty on point. And I'll get into why I agree with that review. But first things last, let's talk about what Signs of the Sojourner actually is. The developer describes it as a narrative card game about connecting with people, which is a nice succinct way of saying what the game is about and a good tell of their intentions with this game. My reading of what the game is in one sentence, as usual, a little more rambling than the dev cut, I say it's a deck-building visual novel and exploration game about conversation and community set in a colourful vision of our climate future. And I have to say that's one of the elements of this game that I loved the most. There are many, many, many post-apocalyptic games out there, and they're all quite dystopian. They all seem to draw on that kind of Mad Max template of the world having gone very, very wrong, people turning against people. But this game is not a post-apocalyptic game. It's a game in which humanity has had to deal with the climate reality that we're in now. It's not a kind of nailed to the mast, kind of flying its colours environmentalist game by any means. But it is a kind of a realistically imagined idea of what a kind of slightly utopian future might look like, in that the world is still peaceful. There are trade caravans that drive from town to town, but the infrastructure of the world in this particular rendition of the future has kind of collapsed. Life is very hard. There is no longer seemingly a kind of a huge commercial, economical machine running countries anymore and running the world. It's more like there are ragtag bunches of people that have formed small communities. And every town that you go to in this game as you drive around this landscape has something going on. For example, in the town of Pachinko, there is an artist community that has an artist's market. There are many artists there making paintings, making sculptures that people swing by to look at. And there is someone there making licorice. The town's famous for the licorice. In the town of Bukamboro, there is a girl called Mathilde who makes matcha. And in the town of Anka, which is an old crumbling city, they seem to salvage a lot of old machinery, so you can get buckets of scrap, spare parts, and electronic things that might be useful. And so every town that you go to has a kind of a little offering, a kind of a little mini economy, a reason for people to go there, and there is a community there that's trying to make things to sell and to get by. There is no violence, there is no Mad Max road gangs. It's all artist communities, farming communities, people that are on the edges of society trying to make a living and to scrape by and to make themselves useful to the wider community, the sort of fractured, disparate community of people. And the community is connected by a trade caravan. So I'll tell you a little bit about the story of this game now. You play an unnamed protagonist from the dusty desert town of Bartow. It's like a small village in the middle of the desert. There's not a lot going on there. There's some sort of tumble-down houses, there's a few people living there, there's a road stop, and there's a shop. And your mother was the owner of the shop until she recently passed away. The game begins just after her funeral, and you have inherited that shop, and you and your childhood friend Elias are trying to come up with a plan to keep the shop going. The shop's very important to Bartow. And the reason that the shop is important to Bartow is that there is a caravan, a trade caravan of merchants, that drives in a loop around the desert from place to place, buying and selling things. And it's important business for the roadhouse in Bartow, and also it brings in stock to restock the shop so that people can buy food and drink and essentials. So the caravan is kind of all important for the town of Bartow's survival. And without the shop, the caravan is thinking of stopping, cutting Bartow from its route around the country. And so you decide with your friend Elias to try and take on this challenge, keep the shop alive, keep the town alive. Elias will take the counter of the shop, and you will join the caravan in your mother's old van and go out on a grand adventure. And I really like that as the start of a game, as the start of a setup, to be going out into the unknown on a road trip. It was really exciting, and I enjoy it every time. And it seems that your character has not been out before. They've lived their lives in Bartow, and so going out to see the world is kind of exciting and invigorating. And that's where the game begins. And as you travel, you'll discover your mum's past, you'll encounter the various personalities and precarious communities who inhabit the landscape, you'll get caught up in all kind of interesting subplots, and find your way to one of the game's many endings. And it's a game that does have many endings. I've played through it several times. I think I'm on my 6th run right now, and so far I've had 4 different endings. And even the 2 that were the same are kind of different. They ended up in different, slightly different scenarios, but the same general ending. So based on the choices that you make, the routes that you take, the people that you meet, and the successes and failures that you have using the game's central conversation mechanic, you'll come to some really different outcomes, and so it's a game with a lot of replayability. And as for the mechanics, the game is built on 3 main aspects. The first one, and probably the smallest, is travelling around a literal map. So at the start of the game, you unfold your map, and the only town on it is Bartow. But when you meet someone new and get into a conversation with them, they might mention a place from your mum's travels, from your mum's stories. Conversations also tell you about the routes on the map, so a different conversation outcome is that you'll get the road to that town. You'll then mark that place on the map. And there are 16 different places to go in total. At the start, it's a process of discovery, and the choices that you make on your first round of the map will inform the places that become open to you. And so that's the traversal aspect of the game. And the other 2 aspects of the game are quite closely intertwined. There is the visual novel style presentation of each location that you arrive at. So when you start out from Bartow, you'll see the map, you'll click on the first town, which is Pechenko, and you'll drive across the map, you'll see your little van icon, go over to Pechenko, and then you're into Pechenko. And what appears first is a picture, a drawing of the city. And the art style is quite interesting. There's like one illustrated card for each location, and they're rendered in quite bright colours. They're quite pretty, they're quite bright, and they give a little bit of atmosphere. And the visual novel style presentation means that you'll see a card for the city, you'll hear the soundtrack of that city, and then several more cards will appear on the screen, each one representing a person that you can talk to. And this is where the main mechanic of the game thrives, and that is the conversation mechanic. So you click on a person, say there's an artist called Alexander, or an art dealer called Marx. And if you click on Marx, then she'll start a conversation, and then the card-based mechanic kicks in. And characters are represented by different symbols that they use in conversation that represent their personalities. And these symbols appear on cards. So, for example, a triangle means logical and diplomatic. A circle means empathic and observant. A diamond means creative and industrious. And a square means direct and forceful. And so when you talk to Marx, I believe that she is a triangle and a circle in her character. Your cards will be spread out in front of you. You'll see 5 cards, and you're going to have to have triangles and circles. So Marx will say a statement like, "Welcome to Pechenko, what do you think of the place?" And a card will drop. If the card ends in a circle on the right-hand side, you have to have a circle card to play. That means that you pass and you get the next segment of conversation. So marks might say, well, I'm glad to hear that. Or if you fail that check because you don't have a circle card, she might say, oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. I thought you might like the place. And so your conversations kind of go through a sequence of card matching based on the hand that you have. And that will dictate whether or not you are successful. And it's an amiable conversation that leads to a preferable outcome, such as a sharing of information or you managing to get some inventory that you can take back to the shop and barter. Whereas if you have a negative outcome, which means perhaps awkwardness or a disagreement of some kind, you'll miss out on that information and you won't get that object to take back to the shop. But the most interesting thing about this is that you own 10 cards at any given time. You see 5 of them on the screen, and you are aware what cards are in your deck, but you can only see half of them at a time. So there's an element of randomness of which cards you'll pull that will dictate how well you do. But at the end of every conversation, you have to pick a card that your conversation partner used, and you have to discard one card from your own deck. So your deck evolves based on who you talk to. So as you head further into the game, let's say you go to the next town of Clifton and you end up in the eastern town of Aldhurst. And in Aldhurst, people don't use circles and triangles anymore. There's a different conversational style in this town. People are much more creative and industrious and logical and diplomatic. And so you're going to end up with some diamond cards that you've gotten from your conversation partners. The good side of that is that the more diverse your card deck is, the more different types of people you have a chance of maintaining a conversation with. But the bad part of that is that when you get back to barter, Elias and the people that you grew up with, they all still speak in triangles and circles. And so you might find that these different conversational styles, different concepts and ideas that you've picked up on your travel. And we all know that that's how travel works. As you travel, you experience new ways of living and thinking, different ideas about life that you'll find in different parts of the world. And that will cause your own kind of self to evolve. It's why we love travel so much. It helps us to evolve as people, to learn new ideas, to not be stuck in a fishbowl of the philosophy that we have about life. And so travel is a really enriching activity. But it's very interesting in this game that as your character becomes more enriched by experiencing more of the world, it means that it's harder to fit in back in the hometown of Barter. So there is a kind of a bittersweet element to the journey of Signs of the Sojourner. It's really quite lyrical. I think it has a lot to say about the way that people interact and the way that they succeed and fail at getting along. It has things to say about diplomacy and empathy and forcefulness that are really interesting. It kind of explores those ideas in quite a subtle way. And I found the deck building element of the game to be really fun, trying to get a balanced deck or trying to collect cards that would make me succeed in a certain part of the map, and then evolving my deck back towards Barter. So on the way home, I try and pick up a couple more circle and triangle cards so that I could have a decent conversation with my best friend Elias when I get home, covered in dust with a truck full of roasted nuts and pickles and scrap metal and matcha, and set them all out on the shelves and try and keep that shop and that town alive. So I really enjoyed those mechanics in the game. It really invested me. The characters that I met in different towns really stick with me for some reason. There's something about the writing of this game that is just very coherent. Like, you'll find out at some point that the caravan itself is solar-powered vehicles, so fossil fuels are gone in this game. You'll find out that in some eastern parts of the map that they are on high cliff sides by the sea, and so they have a good temperature for growing, and they don't have dust storms, and people are envious of them. They can grow vineyards there and make vinegar and wine and things like that. In some towns in the desert, you'll find out that it's just very dry. There is a water shortage, a groundwater shortage. You'll hear hints that communities have had to move because of the lack of groundwater. When you restock your shop, you'll get a little note about who bought each item. And those are really interesting too. It's just one sentence about who bought it, but even that is well considered. For example, there is a hydroponic farmer that will buy the matcha from you, because he wants to research whether or not he can grow tea himself in his hydroponic farm. And so as you're moving around this world and every little encounter that you have, people share incidental details about their lives. They share small colourful stories about the towns that they're from, the difficulties of living in this this very hot landscape where water is scarce, where infrastructure has crumbled. You'll hear people tell you about the roads. They'll say, this is a real nasty road. It really shreds tires. Be very careful as you're taking this uphill journey. And so the life of the caravaneers is a tough one. And the life of these precarious communities is tough too. Nothing is certain. Everyone is just clinging on by their fingernails, it seems like, trying to keep their communities alive. There is no real economy. There is no real society. It's like a dispersed community of people that are just trying to get by. And it's very affecting in that way. It's an image of the future that I've not really seen before in games. I feel like game writing usually gravitates towards the sensational and the dramatic. For example, the post-apocalypse that we see in Horizon Zero Dawn is like a kind of a robot future, where society is just gone and the wrecks of cities are just unpopulated and hazardous. And then in Fallout 4, it's like a post-atomic landscape with radiation and mutants and nasty creatures. And then you have, of course, Mad Max, which is the real template for the dystopian desert future. And this game has a lot more kindness in it than that. It has a lot more humanity in it than that. It's a vision of the future that is really sensitive, that is really rich and warm, full of compassion, full of personality. And for that, I think Signs of the Sojourner deserves real respect, real creative respect for the vision that has been brought forward in this game. This next comparison might sound like a little bit of a stretch, but as I've been speaking, I've been thinking about other games that have given me that sense of warmth in the writing. And there are a couple, and it turns out that they are some of my favourite games, my literal favourite games. For example, you know, in Breath of the Wild, you return again and again to Kakariko Village and to all the different towns, Tarrytown in particular, where you really see the community grow and you help the community grow. And they're so warmly written that it feels like a fictional friend group that you have. And I really feel good when I return to those game environments. And also in Kentucky Route Zero, it's a very different game, but it's another game that really has such well-rounded characters that I think back to Weaver and to Conway and Joseph the gas station attendant, and the playwright who's trying to get his play staged, and the barkeeper, and Junebug and Johnny the musicians. Like, they feel like, in your mind, they exist to me as kind of friends that I liked, because the writing is so good. I feel genuinely warm towards them. And I feel that in Signs of the Sojourner. Like, I feel genuinely invested in finding out what happens to these characters. And part of the replayability of this game is that on different runs through the game, different people will appear in different places at different points in the story. And you can't be everywhere at once. Like, your each trip that you take in the car before you go back to Bartow, it has a deadline of 50 days, and it takes maybe like 7 days to get between different towns. So you can visit 5 or 6 of the towns on each trip, if you're lucky, maybe a few more. And you'll encounter different characters at different points in their own journey through this time period. And so on my third and fourth playthrough, I met characters that I had known since my first playthrough, but they were just at different points in their journey, and I got to find out like how things end for them. And there are still characters that I don't know how their story ends, because I haven't managed to perhaps pass the right conversations, or I haven't just looked into seeing where they ended their journey. And so I think I will keep playing Signs of the Sojourner. I really want to really squeeze all the juice out of this game and find out how it ends for everybody. But as usual, I've saved my little critiques of the game for the end, because I do like to talk about the good parts the most and to really set up the games. The games that I cover on this podcast are pretty much all games. If they are the featured game of the episode, they're all games that I recommend. I like to take good games and to champion them. And Signs of the Sojourner is definitely a game that I champion. However, it is imperfect, it has some flaws, so I'm just going to run through a few of those now. On the bad side, I mean, as you travel, you will get fatigue cards. And these are just a real pain in the arse. Say you're travelling between Clifton and Aldhurst, it's a long drive, or Bukamburo and Aldhurst rather, you'll get a fatigue card for that journey, and that's a card that is unusable. It has no symbols on either side, and it will invade your deck, and you're kind of stuck with it. There are a couple of mechanics for getting rid of fatigue cards. For example, you'll get a random road encounter that allows you to discard one fatigue card. You'll also at some point meet a dog, and you will sometimes be allowed to play with your dog, which will allow you to remove one fatigue card. But you can usually expect to go home with five or six or more fatigue cards. And when you have that many, it is actually possible to just pull an entire hand of fatigue cards and to just watch perhaps a key conversation that is really going to affect how the game outcome occurs just be absolutely unplayable. And you will have personal connections to some of these characters that you enjoy your relationship and you really want to do a good job and you really want to support them and to be a nice presence in their lives. And if you've just pulled a handful of fatigue cards, you basically have to watch your conversation go down in flames, watch yourself alienate these people that you've come to really enjoy. And honestly, this mechanic is broken. There are many ways that they could have made it good. They could have made it so that, for example, say there's a location that's a desert oasis that you can visit, and there is a location called Grey Cambit that's just a beautiful beach. And each one of them allows you to discard one fatigue card, as does playing with the dog. If they had allowed playing with the dog or stopping at the spa to clear your fatigue cards, it would have been a much kinder game consideration for the player. Because, I mean, even after playing five or six runs through the game, you're always carrying a lot of fatigue cards when you come to the far corners of the map, where some of the best intrigue and plot elements are happening. And so you're just hamstrung in some of the key moments of the game by this mechanic. It's just unnecessary. Honestly, it's just a real mistake. If you play the game, you'll see what I mean. And there are still endings to some of the relationships that I've missed because of this mechanic, and I'm just a bit sad about that. I think it could have been handled better. And that leads me on to a second one, which is in the conversation mechanic with the cards. Sometimes you just have no chance of winning, basically. I have come to prepare decks that have circles and diamonds in them because there's one corner of the map that I'm yet to get the final mystery from. So I've done playthroughs that were entirely focused on getting circles and diamonds so that I could talk to those people. But sometimes you talk to a circle and diamond person, you only have one strike in that conversation. You'll have different amounts of strikes. Sometimes you have four strikes because it's a very easy and amiable conversation partner. Sometimes you have one strike, and that means that if you mess up once, you're out, and you're out for the game, you're out for that run. And so I've come to a conversation with a circle and diamond person, put down a circle, turns out they don't have one. And that's the two symbols that you know that they're supposed to have are circle and diamond. They didn't have one of them. And so through no fault of your own, you've just lost one of the endings of the game. That's really mean. I feel like the characters that have circles and diamonds should always have circles and diamonds. Just to offer you a chance of playing well, getting the best optimal deck for that person and getting through a conversation, to have a one-strike conversation where you can play perfectly and lose is, to put it mildly, a questionable piece of game design, in my opinion. So despite the fact that I loved the game, there are a couple of bugbears that I had with it. I will say that I do think this is an absolutely fabulous game. It's rich, it's beautifully designed and illustrated. I mean, I haven't talked about the art style, but it's just so colourful. It's all pink sunsets and orange sand. It's bright, it's vivid. The characters are illustrated in what looks like somewhere between like a marker illustration and an MS Paint drawing. So it's pretty simple, but very striking. The writing is all just perfect. It's so warm. All of the characters have really sympathetic stories, and they all entangle so well. And as a collective work, every character that you talk to helps to elevate this vision of the future that Signs of the Sojourner so quietly has. Like I said, it's not a game that nails its colours to the mast and says this is about climate future, but everyone that you talk to helps to fill in the gaps of what happened to society, about the droughts, about diseases that have kind of blighted the population. And you'll just find these things out in incidental comments. I mean, the main thrust of the story is the very small story of trying to restock your shop and keep Bartow alive. So this wider story about the world itself is told between the lines in a really effective and brilliant way. So there is so much to love about this game. Echo Dog have done an amazing job. I'm really happy to see that the game has come onto consoles. I'm really happy to see that people are talking about it. I was really happy to see that it's been reviewed in publications like The Guardian. So it is one of those games that just has such a strong creative thrust behind it that it's one of the ones that got out of the traditional games media and started crossing over into more mainstream media. And I think it deserves that. I had a great time with it. I'm taking a break now because I've done 5 or 6 rounds of the game. I played it every day. My first run through took 4 hours. I think I got it down to maybe 1.5 or 2 for my latter runs. So I've probably spent 10 to 15 hours playing the game. I'm taking a break now because I've kind of come to a dead end because of those flaws in the game that I mentioned just now. But I have nothing but warmth towards it. I have been passionately advocating for this game to my friends, trying to get them to play it. It's the kind of game that I think anyone who's got an interest in the kind of games that this podcast is about, in artistic games, in narrative games, in games with a vision, unusual, independent productions, should play Signs of the Sojourner. So it's a hard recommendation from me. I will come back to it again. I really want to get to those final map locations and discover the final secrets of the game. That's Signs of the Sojourner. So that was Signs of the Sojourner. I hope you liked hearing about it. I certainly enjoyed playing it. It turns out that I have feelings about that game. Maybe you noticed in the way that I was talking about it. But I do have strong feelings about that game, actually. I loved it so much, and I felt so attached to some of those characters. And I did feel a little aggrieved that I wasn't able to be the kind of friend to them that I kind of wanted to. It's really interesting to have such a kind of a strong emotional reaction to a game, and I absolutely love that. More games that elicit a strong emotional reaction from the player, please. So that's our show. I'll be back next week with a new one. If you would like to come and join me on social media to talk about Signs of the Sojourner, if you played maybe Iris and the Giant, which I reviewed last week, if you have thoughts about card-based games, about game design, about the kind of indie games and narrative games that you like, if you've got a recommendation that you'd like to hear me talk about on the show, you can find me on Twitter at GamingInTheWild. I'm on there every day. You can also find me on Instagram, YouTube, Twitch, and Facebook. I do stream occasionally. I'm about to upgrade my computer, so hopefully I'll be streaming more in the future. My little dual-core Mac isn't quite up to the task, but I'll be getting a new one soon. If you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to hear more, there are several patron-only episodes available for patrons of the show. You can become one of those and join our Discord community at patreon.com/gamingInTheWild. I also have a Ko-fi account if you'd like to make a one-off tip. That's at ko-fi.com/gamingInTheWild. My patron goal for this year and my Ko-fi goal for this year is just to make the show break even. So thank you very much if you'd like to help me make that happen. And for anyone that's listening on Apple Podcasts, it really helps me out and it helps the show out to reach more people, the more ratings and reviews that the show has. So if you happen to be on an iPhone right now or listening via iTunes, I really appreciate dropping a 5-star review on the podcast and even writing a few words if you have the time. And a side effect of that is cheering me up. I love to read the reviews. It's so nice to get feedback on the show, whether it's via social media or via Patreon supporters, or even just via ratings and nice reviews about the show. It's lovely to get that feedback. So thanks very much for listening. I'll be back next week. I'm not sure what game I'll be talking about yet. Maybe Bioshock Infinite, maybe Immortals Fenyx Rising, which I'm planning to finish this week if I can. Maybe something else completely. I'm just going to keep you in suspense for now. Thanks very much for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other. Bye-bye for now.